Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, I use and really highly recommend GoToMyPC to remotely access another computer. You know, maybe you haven't tried GoToMyPC because, it seems too complicated. But let me tell you something. It's easy to set up, and it's really easy to use. First, all that you have to do is you have to sign up for a free trial. Go to GoToMyPC.com/podcast. And make sure that you're at the computer that you want to access it, download it, and set it up. It takes about 2 minutes. Then from any computer you're at, log in to GoToMyPC.com with your secure password and click the Connect button. You can go to MyPC and get a 30-day free trial. So visit GoToMyPC.com/podcast and check it out. I really highly recommend it. Again, it's GoToMyPC.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com. The internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/investor. Hey, welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me today. It's, episode 112. We're in the beginning of June. The summer's upon us. Going to be a beautiful summer, I am sure of it. Down here in Florida, it gets rather muggy, rainy, and extraordinarily humid. You know, I'm always amazed. You know, have you heard about the heat in Florida in the summer? It's just unbearable. It's correct. Trust me on this. But you know, I always hear from people who live, like, let's say in Arizona, in Vegas. They talk about how, oh boy, it's 110 in the summer. But you know, it's not humid. It's a dry heat. And I'm thinking, what are you kidding me? I've been to Vegas in the summertime. It is unbearable. I had a bus pass me by when I was walking down the street. I was on the sidewalk. The bus passed me by, and this wave of intense heat. It was like I was in a blast furnace. So in a sauna. So all right. So one's a steam room, one's a sauna. But nonetheless, it was a sauna. So for all of you in Vegas, all of you in all the dry heat areas of the summer, I wish you well. And I would suggest if you want to keep that. Good skin though. Down here in Florida, the moisture is wonderful. Nonetheless, markets have been interesting. We've seen some great interesting news. Also, we saw a unbelievable job number on Friday, which I talked to Frank Herzio about. As a matter of fact, because what really happened on Friday, it was a bit of a fake out. As a matter of fact, what happened was we got this job number of 345 on the claims, and we got a 9.4. Ouch on the actual rate of unemployment. But what was interesting was not one analyst came out with an estimate that was anywhere near 345, because we've been averaging somewhere like 550, 600, 700, 500. What happened? Well, what happened was that arbitrarily, the powers that be that created the report, that create these statistics, added their birth-death model into this particular equation and boosted it by 220,000 jobs. The period before, they did about 76,000 jobs. Because that was that temporary number that faked us out with the Census Bureau that was put on. But this time they used 220 extra thousand jobs. So in other words, the real number was 565. That was the real number if they didn't include this birth-death model, which was essentially the estimates of how many businesses are no longer in existence and how many new ones have come to be, new businesses that are hiring. And a little more complicated than that, but essentially it was a 565 number. So you wonder why the futures popped in the morning, right when that number came out. Now, here's what's interesting about that, and I want to share something with you. So as investors, we have to have a game plan. We always talk about this. And the game plan we had was very, very, it was clear. If we saw a number, let's say, that was over 550 and an unemployment rate higher than 9.3, well, we were going to have to consider, you know what, we may want to hedge out this portfolio. We want to maybe go short because that's a real big problem. Unemployment is spiking. We have a big problem. Okay, fine. Put that aside. On the other hand, if we see unemployment, which is a very important number, maybe under 5 and maybe under 9, it really hasn't spiked up and we're getting some hiring. Well, maybe that's an opportunity to, you know, not hedge and add to some positions. Add to your current positions, add to other positions. Okay, you got that? But what we saw was a number that just defied anything, any logic really, and it created a massive move in the markets in the pre-market after the number came out. The S&P futures, Dow Jones, the NASDAQ, they spiked like 1.5% on that news. 1.5% because it was seemingly an unbelievably good number. None of the analysts had that number anywhere. Nobody was thinking that kind of number. I think the lowest analyst was like 475 on the number. So what happened was, if you wonder why, in fact, on Friday that the market started trending up in the early part of the morning and then they kind of came down very hard, it was because the realization hit that there was something wrong underneath. And the lesson here is that there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of anticipation in the markets right now. People are very concerned and very confused, and the psychology of the markets are really just all over the place right now. And that's why we're getting these gigantic leaps and these big drops and this fear, this greed. It's a real problem. So you have to make sure that you read thoroughly the reports. And I'll tell you, it faked us out too, because we were really concerned when that happened. We've seen some crazy things happen in this market, and just we were not interested in getting any part of a number that was at 345. I said, wait a minute, what is going on? We pulled our hedges too early, to be honest with you. And that's, you know, I don't, it's not an amateur or a professional mistake. It's you know, we reacted to the numbers according to plan. And unfortunately, the numbers, buried within the numbers, was another number that was very difficult to discern initially because, again, the headline number really pushed the market dramatically. Well, with that in mind, I also want to share with you, we talk about psychology. I thought, what a great opportunity. Even though I mentioned we were going to talk about economy and economics a little bit, we'll save that for a minute. I thought, what a great opportunity to talk about psychology, because there's so much, I think there's a lot of apprehension and people are really nervous, of course. And are we going up? Are we going down? What's happening next? I mean, can we trust the numbers? So I thought we'd do is bring an old friend, Brett Steenbarger, who is the psychology of the psychologist for the markets. That's what his specialty is. He is a psychologist and specializes in investment issues. We've had him on before. You probably know him from his great website. And I thought I'd bring him on today and we'd ask him some questions. I have lots of questions to ask him. And then what I thought we'd do also is have a chat with a gentleman who we spoke with last summer when oil prices were approaching 140. As we saw it clip the $70 per barrel mark this week, I said, you know what? Maybe it's time to bring him back. He was involved with the Enron loophole issue, which we talked about so much last year, and really trying to bring a closure to the manipulation in the oils and commodity markets. And I thought we'd bring him back. His name is Professor Greenberger, and he's at the University of Maryland and was former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the CTFC. So I thought we'd have a good show for you today on that. And, you know, I think it's going to be action-packed enough. And next week, we will definitely have some economic discussion and how to read some of these economic numbers to understand what the important ones are or not. Forgive me for not doing it this time. I thought this would be much more important for this podcast. Check me out. I was on Frank Curzio and TheStreet.com's Real Story podcast last week. Friday, I was on for the entire episode. Usually it has about two or three names on per episode, but we had a chat that just lasted a long time. He's a great guy, Frank, and I encourage you to listen to his podcast. And if anybody has any questions for me, of course, write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you want to see how we manage money, check out the 14-minute video tutorial. It's a virtual tour that we have on our website. We'll put a link in the show notes and all the information about all the guests that are on this particular show in the show notes as well. Come visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com as often as possible. We have all sorts of good things that are going on there and things that we write about and report on. So with that, let's get on with the show. And I'm going to dial in with Dr. Brett, psychologist for the markets, right when we get back on the Disciplined Investor podcast. Stay tuned. You know, I just want to mention something to you. You know, I love audible.com because I personally love listening and learning, and I listen to podcasts all the time. I have my iPhone and iPod 2, you know, computer. But audible.com has a great, it's just an amazing library of books that you can read on tape. And listen to on tape really is the thing. And they have a free offer for you. And I encourage you, you know, they sponsor this show and it can't hurt to check it out. If you enjoy listening to podcasts, or you enjoy learning about business or even fiction or, you know, biographies or just a whole massive amount of things that you can listen to, check it out. Go to audiblepodcast.com/investor and get a free trial. And it's really neat because you get kind of a free 30-day and What happens then is you get your free book and you don't have to give it back if you don't want to continue it. So that's real easy. Go check it out. audiblepodcast.com/investor. You know, every once in a while, folks, we got to get a little bit of a mind cleanse. And we've had him on before. Brett Steenbarger is the psychologist, the psyche, the helper for the investor. He is a real smart guy when it comes to understanding risk-reward, understanding the psychology of the market and the psychology of the investor. And I thought it was about time that we brought him back to discuss some of this because it is a very stressful time in these markets. So, Brett, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Right. So, you know, what is it that you know, between your traders and investors and your corporate clients, I mean, there's a lot of stress in them, you know, with them right now. I'm sure there's a mixed bag, but, you know, what's the general consensus?
Well, yeah, I would say there's stress, and particularly stress related to uncertainty. You know, the $64,000 question for many investors out there is, do I trust this rally that we've seen since early March? You know, we hear some pretty grisly economic statistics about unemployment. On the other hand, we hear that the sentiment is bouncing a little bit upward. There might be some green shoots in the economy. And so there's a great deal of uncertainty. People have seen their portfolios bounce up from the lows. Do they stay in positions? Do they get out and take it while they can? Lots of uncertainty about that, and I think that's causing a lot of the stress.
What about the volatility? Because one of the things that I find uncomfortable often is the volatility. You know, just this on a daily basis, you don't know towards the end. It's kind of like a basketball game, you know? Do you really need to stay to watch the whole game or maybe the last 15 minutes, right? It's kind of like the markets these days, right?
Well, it sure feels that way, and you're raising a great question. You know, it's interesting, if you look on a day-to-day basis, volatility has been coming down quite a bit since March. The VIX, which is an option-based measure of volatility, is down. And if you look at the average range for the S&P 500 index, that is way down from what we were seeing in the fall of 08 and early in 09. Mm-hmm. However, the day-to-day volatility masks intraday volatility, the volatility that we see hour to hour, and particularly during the late afternoon hours of the day, we have been seeing some unprecedented volume and volatility. And so if you're an investor and you're staying away from the screen and just following the market on an end-of-day basis, you probably don't see too much of that. But if you get closer to the market and you're watching it during the day, it can be very stressful.
Yeah, no, I, you know, that magical 3:30 time when you don't know if they're going to take it down 2% or up 2% is quite astonishing. I mean, and oftentimes for absolutely no reason. There's been some discussion out there about the robot traders and the quant traders that are taking up a lot of the space in the markets, you know, creating a lot of the underlying. And then, you know, you hear that when you talk to many of the retail desks, they're dead. There's nobody, you know, out there that's doing a lot of trading. I mean, have you heard this too?
Absolutely, and I work with firms where those kinds of traders and trading machines are dominating. And certainly that's been a long-term trend, that institutional trading, including algorithmic trade or computerized trade, has taken over from retail trade. But you have a number of computer programs, algorithms, trading close to the market, basically making markets, at the same time that you have a number of speculators trading in a discretionary way close to the market, trading high frequency. Mm-hmm. And when all of those participants act in a herd, you get these violent moves late in the day. And the hard thing for an investor to appreciate is that those moves, most of the time, have nothing to do with fundamentals.
Well,
they have
surely
Nothing to do with the long-term outlook. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's so scary to see your position go against you 1%, 2% right in a few minutes, that it's easy to get spooked out of very good investments.
Right. So what about you know, the whole idea of ETFs? You know, there's been a lot of discussion about you know, inverse and double ETFs on whether just, you know, the S&P or a particular sector. You know, they think that there's some three timers out there with direction funds.
Yep, yep.
And sure. I believe that ProFunds is putting an application for, I think it's 94 three-time beta funds. I don't know if you hear about that?
Not that particular one, but certainly the direction funds and, yeah. and the ultras have been very popular. Absolutely, the leveraged ETFs basically allow the stock trader to participate like a futures trader.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot more leverage than the traditional 2-to-1 that the retail trader has had. And so as more volume has come into those ETFs, much of which, by the way, is from portfolio managers of hedge funds, as large volume comes into those, you get this situation where the fund managers for the ETFs have to rebalance their portfolios late in the day, and that can end up magnifying moves that are already underway.
Yeah, and,
so
that, and that's
buying,
actually,
buying, buying late
right,
in the day,
right.
They have to buy, buy, buy,
right.
So their portfolio represents the market. And so you sort of get a market chasing its own tail and amplifying whatever's going on.
Well, in fact, Barclays put out a piece recently that said that they actually, for their select clients, they would put out a daily piece of what they think is going to be the most rebalanced and what to look for when they rebalance their shares late in the day so the clients have an edge on what to buy.
Yeah, and of course, the stock exchanges announce imbalances late in the day, right?
Right.
So, you know, and I think that information ends up being relevant because you get a sense of whether people are leaning long or short, and that gives you a little clue about where that balancing might take place.
The problem, Brett, is that price discovery is getting killed.
Price discovery is really hurt, particularly for the active investor. In other words, if you're a buy and hold or a longer-term market participant, you can really stand apart from that noise. I mean, you probably shouldn't be following the market mm-hmm. hour to hour.
Mm-hmm.
I have a principle as a psychologist working with traders that you'll always trade the time frame that you watch.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch the market minute by minute, you're going to end up trading the market.
Right.
minute by minute. And you know, so if you're a long-term investor, you really need to stand apart from the noise, follow the market at the end of the day, you know, and see what's going on, follow the news and the big fundamental information, but stand apart from that noise short term. On the other hand, if you're an active trader or investor and your holding period is maybe a day, 2 days, 3 days, you're trading a swing period, you've got to be sensitive to price movement within the day, and those are the folks who are really challenged.
Yeah, you're talking to one right now in one part of our portfolios. We have multiple portfolios, and I got to tell you something. The moves are no longer 0.5% in a stock, that is, 1%, 2%. They're like 5% at a clip. And having any kind of downside risk mitigation kind of, you know, is like you got to be careful because entry points are extremely important.
Well, yeah, you've just raised a great, great issue, and I discuss this with my portfolio managers, and that is the critical importance of execution skills, getting a good price for your positions, and it helps to have some short-term trading skills to execute longer-term positions well. And so what the portfolio managers I work with are doing, they will, if they want to be long, they will wait for one of these herd effects
mm-hmm.
to swipe the market down
mm-hmm.
before they buy.
Right.
Or they'll,
right.
if they want to sell, they'll wait for the herd to come in, and then they'll sell against it. Psychologically,
yep.
that's difficult
yeah.
because it looks like it's going to the moon or it's
right.
tanking to zero
right.
at that moment. But that's what gives you the good price.
Right.
Because typically, those big swipe moves are not based on fundamentals, and much of them will eventually retrace.
Right. Let me just set up one scenario for you, and then I want to ask you some questions because I know a lot of people have called me and you know and written me about you know what do I do? And there's three mm-hmm. different you know probably people we can discuss. But here's a scenario. Sure. Let me tell me if this makes any sense at all to you. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll end this. But on this point on the subject. But you know, early morning futures. Let's both say that the futures market is less. I don't want to say regulated, but there's a lot more leverage and a lot different than the regular stock market. And you could
sure.
really control a vast amount of stocks, let's call it the S&P 500, in a futures basket, if you will, with a smaller amount of money and leveraged extremely high. Is that so far so good?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. If you're particularly if you are trading for a member firm of one of the futures exchanges, and so you can trade particularly on a day time frame with very high leverage, absolutely, you can really move some size.
Okay. So now, so hold that thought. Right now, let's say this: the market, let's say that it's moving down the futures at any given time, pre market or during the market, and you get a block that you leverage up dramatically. You take a giant chunk of money, on the other hand, and you put it in a 2x leveraged, let's say, S&P 500 ETF. Okay?
Yes.
Now, that's sitting there at the lows, right? You just invested that. Maybe because nothing really happens with that. You're not going to push that too much. You can get in there because it's, you know, how it works. Now what happens is you start pushing that future. You go in there and you push those futures up dramatically, and you leverage and you blow up the markets. And essentially, on a smaller amount of money, you've made a big move in markets, and you capitalize that on the other side with a large amount of money in that ETF. How's that sound?
Yes, you would still need a good amount of contracts, a good amount of money in the futures to move it significantly. The S&P futures are deep enough as a market that you're not going to trade 500 contracts and
no, I'm talking the next level. I'm talking about, you know, 50 million, 100 million bucks at a clip.
Right, right.
And let's say, for example, I don't know, if I was, I'm making something up here, but, you know, I was a bank that got a bunch of TARP money that I didn't need or something, I don't know.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Something like that. And I could use those to kind of, you know, blow it out on one side and pick it up on the other and, you know, kind of make my own profits just by doing that all day long. How's that sound?
Yes. Now, what they claim, I mean, there are institutions, I'm not going to mention names, but there are institutions that are using their funds to participate in these markets in a programmatic way, including the futures. What they claim is that they are doing so purely in a non-directional market-making capacity. So they are basically bidding and offering and adding liquidity to the system.
That's because they're nice guys.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say, you know? Okay. Now, in fact, and a large part of that could be true. Probably not too many of your listeners are familiar with market-making firms in the electronic futures, but the way they operate, you know, they can certainly bid and offer, and yet in the way that they place bids and offers at various points in the market, at various, if you think of the depth of market on a ladder, so prices below where we're trading, prices above, you know, how you array your bids and offers can end up having some directional impact.
Right.
And so I think that there may be a thin line there, but it's true that you can get moves that begin in the futures that get the futures out of line with the underlying stock, and then the arbitrageurs will buy the stocks and sell the futures in a program trade to bring them back in line.
Right.
And so, indirectly, by buying the futures, you've created buying in the stocks. That's
So let's just say this and end on this. The scenario that I just built is not impossible.
Oh, no. It happens regularly. I mean, you can see the futures going out of line with fair value on a pretty regular basis, and then you can see buying or selling coming into the stocks based on the futures getting out of line. That's
right. And then when you have the leverage on the other side, like an ETF is all at 2 and 3x, that's why we get those giant pushes. Because if you make on a giant block of money 1% from 3:40 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that's a pretty good scratch.
Right, right. It would affect those leveraged ETFs.
All right, so let's go on to something totally different. There's three sets of people. Number one, you have people that were in the markets and they've stayed in the markets from forever. They bought and held, whether it's a mutual fund, whether it's stocks, whatever.
Yes.
They've been through the abyss and back, not back totally, but you know, still down 30-40% maybe. But that's where they are. You have another set of people who pulled out money maybe early. And didn't participate in any of the up or down. Then you have people that maybe pulled out late, you know, that they pulled out sometime in February, let's say, or March, and, either maybe did get back in or didn't. For those people that let's say, that, have been in the market and you know, buy and hold. Let's assume they're not going to do anything. They're going to buy and hold. They're going to stay there. They have a little more confidence since it's come up a little bit. For those people that, you know, were out of the market for a while and started to get back in and all that, you know, where is it that they can kind of get over their concern about, you know, is the market going to go fall back? That's been a big thing that I've kind of been getting emails about. Is this, you know, the quote unquote, is this rally for real? Well, of course it's for real. It's just happened. You know, the question is, you know, can it be trusted? Is it going to go back down? You know, how does, you know, what do you tell them to get over that kind of psychological fear?
Well, that some of the fears is could be well grounded. That sometimes just because someone's fearful doesn't mean that their fear is irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we look at market history, at secular bear markets, and I do believe we're in a secular bear market,
mm-hmm.
That there can be long periods of bottoming before a secular bull market emerges.
Right.
So, for instance, we hit a price bottom in 1932 with mm-hmm. the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
and we had another recession and hits of prices in 37.
Mm-hmm.
But, in fact, the secular bull didn't start until the late 40s when World War II was over and money started flowing into the economy that had been used for the wartime. And so there was a long period of up and down market action that was not the greatest for investors, but was a pretty good trading environment. We had a bottom in 1974, price-wise, in the Dow, but the secular bull market didn't take off until August of 82. And so you had 8 years between 74 and 82 where we went quite a bit higher in 75, 76, and then came down in 77 and early 78, and then came back up and then came back down, and then those October crashes, and then you had 1980 come up and then back down, and then it kind of petered down into 82. So it was really not a good investment environment, mm-hmm. particularly given inflation, between 74 and 82 before the secular bull took hold. So I think that even if you grant that March was the secular bear low in
mm-hmm.
price,
right?
Even if you assume that, which there could be reason to have doubts about how good an investment environment we'll have in coming years, and it would not be so unusual for this secular bear market to last, you know, 15, 16 years, like we had in from 29 going into the 40s, and like we had in 1966 to 1982.
You're saying the secular bear market.
Secular bear market.
Right.
You know, can last, you know, 16 years or so, and so we topped out, I believe, in 2000. And so it would not be unusual from my vantage point to see more years of either a choppy or muddling kind of environment for investors. And so I think what investors need to do is think about, you know, where value lies. And to me, the greatest question that a longer-term investor needs to ask is, are we staying in a deflationary environment, or are we transitioning to an inflationary environment?
Mm-hmm.
That is such an important question for the investor.
That
will determine how you deploy your assets. And I think investors right now, including this one, need good, sage perspective on that issue.
Yeah, because, from everything we're seeing, I mean, oil prices, commodity prices going up, hello, but we're hearing deflation, you know, and it's kind of a very odd situation where we're seeing things go up. We're seeing the clear creation of dollars by our government in particular, others too.
Yeah.
And everything says all over it inflation, but yet the powers that be say deflation, which is kind of a little weird.
Yeah, and the powers that be right now, I think, are saying reflation as opposed to inflation. You know, that we had deflation and now we're just kind of getting a normal amount of money into the circulation. But in fact, when you look at the huge sums that we are dumping into mm-hmm. the world economy, it's easy for reflation to become inflation.
Yep.
And so I think an investor would want to think about, okay, if we're transitioning to an inflationary environment, over the next how many years, how can I protect myself? And you start to think of tips, and you start to think of different kind of investments that might make sense even if the market muddles through for a number of years.
Yeah. And then finally, the real question then is that, and I think this is the thing that really is perplexing to me. You know, if we just level off at this point with the markets, just level off, and then slowly but gloriously, just gently up and down, but gently climb for a number of years, let's say, okay? And the recession is quote unquote over sooner, or maybe next quarter, the quarter after, the quarter after that. I mean, not within a reasonable amount of time, okay?
Right.
This market event, with its top to bottom, this vicious top to bottom, was about, we'll say 1 year. I'll just say 1 year, okay? Not all of it. I'm saying the real choppy, horrid, you know, top to bottom market move before it, mm-hmm. you know, turned around and then got into a bullish mode or whatever.
Right.
In 2000, it took 2.5 to 3 years for the same thing to occur. And what's interesting is that was a isolated incident that spread into a much bigger issue that had nothing to do with credit, had nothing to do with the banks, had nothing to do with, you know, evaporation of money and all that. And it would be almost amazing to me if we're out of this one so fast. Does that seem out of the question?
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point. And just because we bounce in price, does that really mean we're out of it? And I think the 1974 bottom is a good example. We ended up loosening the monetary spigot, and we got quite a bounce into 1976, only for 6 more years after that to go down in price, and mm-hmm. particularly on an inflation-adjusted basis.
Right.
So, absolutely, we could bounce from here. You put enough liquidity into the system, it finds its home in stocks, but that doesn't mean that we're out of the woods so quickly.
Right.
And I would argue, by the way, that the way you'll know that the bull market is over is by following the emerging markets, not by following the U.S.
And watching when they roll over.
Watching while they roll over, because the liquidity is going into, you know, liquidity has to find a new bubble, right?
Mm-hmm.
And look at China. You know,
Let's say it again. Liquidity needs to find a new bubble. I like that. Because, you know, we can't just have conservative or a moderate anything. It has to be, you know, at 100 miles an hour, full speed ahead.
Yep. Because that extra capital has to find a speculative home.
Right.
And so I believe one of those speculative homes is the emerging markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so China has been up furiously since March,
mm-hmm.
and Brazil and so forth. So when you see those rolling over, when you find out, oh, the Chinese were manufacturing a lot of their statistics,
mm-hmm.
they were throwing bad loans at their companies,
mm-hmm.
and this was really a house of cards to some degree, that's when everything becomes vulnerable.
Yeah, well, some of it's starting to show its face already.
There are some hints of that, but that's why I would follow it. And for your listeners, EEM is the ETF for emerging markets. It's a pretty liquid, pretty actively traded ETF, EEM. And it's a nice way of just tracking. You know, just look at that versus mm-hmm. the S&P 500. Yep. Nice way of tracking strength in the emerging market.
I hear. Brett Steenberger, thank you so much. We're going to tell people you need to go to traderfeed.blogspot.com. I believe that's what it is. We're going to put a link in the show notes. You have some books. I would encourage people to go get Brett's books. I would encourage people to subscribe to his daily blog. This is one smart fellow that goes beyond the basics to discover what's going on with the psychology, the behavioral finance inside the markets. And I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Brett. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. And, you know, about a year ago, folks, we had a very special guest. His name is Professor Greenberger, and he was a former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CTFC. We talk about that a lot because we talk about some of the things that are going on in the world of commodities and what's happening in particular with oil, with the contango issue, and you know, what's happening with the oil. And last year, if you recall very correctly, I had a bit of hysteria when it was coming to the idea of oil being 140, and that the whole world was saying it was supply demand, and I was saying it can't be, it doesn't make any sense. And Professor Greenberger testified before the before Congress, and really, you know, shed some light on this whole issue of what was happening with you know, the oil issues. So I said I have to have him back because I feel like I'm stepping back in time. So, Professor Greenberger, how are you?
I'm very good. Glad to be with you.
Thanks. So tell me something. Do you also feel like that you've stepped back in time?
Oh, there's no two ways about it. I'm, and certainly you and I are not alone in that regard. Last summer, starting in mid-July, working our way through about Labor Day, there were some tentative and temporary regulatory steps and threats, solid threats of congressional action, which I think drove speculators from the market. And mid-July, the price, as you know, was at 147. I believe by sometime in February, it dropped all the way down to 33.
Mm-hmm.
And as you've stated, there's been no dramatic difference in supply-demand problems. In fact, right now, our supplies are at record high and relative record highs, and our demands are at relative record lows.
Right.
But since it dropped to 33, the price has started to spiral back up again. Goldman is warning that this is going to be another spike. And I think most of us who labored in these vineyards in terms of trying to find corrective actions believe that we came very, very close last summer in sort of closing the door on speculation, but we didn't quite close it all the way. I think there was a false sense of security by the fact that the price went in 8 months from 147 to 33. I think many people thought, well, we've licked this problem. But in fact, the door wasn't fully closed. There are still dark markets in which excessive speculation, and I surmise even worse, probably manipulation, are going on. One of the handicaps right now, interestingly enough, is, you know, the problem with the unregulated futures market or the deregulated futures market is very closely parallel to the unregulated swaps market.
Mm-hmm.
And as the oil price went down, everybody's regulatory attention focused on the problems of deregulated swaps, most specifically credit default swaps, which were the engine that these credit default swaps are essentially insurance policies that insured all these unsound bets, but unlike regulated insurance, the people who gave the insurance never set aside the capital. So you had companies like AIG offering $400 billion of insurance out of a little subsidiary on a $200 billion equity base. And so a lot of attention was turned to the swaps market and what we're going to do about the swaps market. And while the attention was drawn away, there was a lack of focus on the deregulated energy markets. One of the problems we're facing right now is there is a substantial momentum is being developed at global re-regulation of these dark markets across the board. So you have concerns about financial swaps, interest rate swaps, currency swaps, credit default swaps, and the deregulated energy market. But as they've expanded the things they want to do to create regulatory reform, the predictions of the time it will take to put these restrictions in place are moving, you know, into next fall. And I think there's beginning to be a view that is starting to be heard, needs to be made louder, that the fix for the oil markets is quite simple. We almost locked the door last summer, and now we've got to go forward. And in addition, you know, it's quite ironic, the new chair of the CFTC, who's only been in office for about 2 weeks, was a former Goldman Sachs partner a deputy secretary of the Treasury. People were expecting more of the same, but he has, in fact, he promised, and just yesterday he delivered testimony in Congress that shows, to me at least, that his heart is in the right place. And I think our mission right now is to focus Gary Gensler, the new chair of the CFTC, the Obama administration, and Congress on the fact that you first have to deal with the oil markets. Get those under control. Those are baby steps. And then do the more difficult thing, which is control the multi-trillion-dollar financial swaps market.
Right. Now, one of the things that happened last year was that there was this whole big hoo-ha and brouhaha about this Enron loophole because of the lack of oversight of the ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange, where oil was being exchanged. Basically, there was massive leverage. There was nobody had to come out and say who they were. Now, after I talked to you, and I did a lot of research on this, and one of the things I could never figure out for a while why it was that oil dropped precipitously on that particular day. Because there was all these things that were happening and all these things colliding until I found something. And to tell me, you know, what you think of this. I haven't talked to you since, I don't think. What happened was there was a regulation in the CTFC that said that there was a separation between two types of traders, essentially. There were speculators and there were, let's call it non-speculators, I guess the best word. And again, not in a bad sense or a good sense, just what it was. One were like the farmers that were trying to cover their crops, and the other were just people that were, you know, investors. And there were different rules about exposing what they held in their portfolios. In fact, if you were considered, I believe, a farmer, it wasn't required, right? And so what happened was that, therefore, anything that you held inside your portfolio, whatever leverage you're using, could be totally hidden and really dark market, you know, through the dark markets. And the day that that changed, whether it was coincidence or not, but it seems logical, what a day when everybody was required to expose their positions, that's when it dropped off the fate just straight down. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And unfortunately, when you say they changed the regulations, they did not do a global change. They called out a couple of players and said, look, you're masking yourself as someone who physically handles oil and can engage in all the contractual commitments you want to enter into. And they called a couple of people out and said, you're not a commercial holder, you're a speculator, therefore you're subject to speculation limits. That is, your participation in these markets has got to be constrained. Unfortunately, along with the theme I've talked to you about, there were measures taken on a tentative and temporary basis, such as the one you're indicating, that temporarily deflated these markets. Unfortunately, as we sit here today, nothing permanent has been put into place to ensure that speculators in these markets are limited to just enough participation that creates liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are two points I want to make about that. People confuse the futures market with the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
The stock market, you buy a stock and you hope you hit a home run.
Right.
And that's a legitimate desire. The futures market is a risk-shifting market. It's used by commercial individuals, for example, heating oil dealers or heating oil customers, to hedge their price exposure. You're not supposed to hit a home run. You're supposed to just ensure, using the market, that at the end of the producing season, you will either get a reasonable price for your commodity or you'll pay a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
And speculators are only invited into that market to create enough liquidity to let it function. What has happened is that speculators have taken these markets over, unmoored them from economic fundamentals, driven at the commercial handlers, and they're converting it into a home run market, hoping that the price will just go through the roof and they will collect profits based not on the commodity itself, but on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
The second point I would make is this problem is now in the ether. It is out there. The Obama administration is alert to it. There are many powerful members of Congress that are alert to it. The problem is, let's not worry about trying to fix everything in the short term. When I say everything, the credit default swaps market, the interest rate swaps, currency swaps, let's nail down this oil price thing. It's doable. Now, while a lot of people are paying attention to it, I can assure you the powerful lobbying interests will be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, offering every reason under the sun why nothing should be done. But I think we're at a point in time where something can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people who care about it, they should be contacting the chair of the CFTC, Gary Gensler. They should be contacting the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Colin Peterson, the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, Tom Harkin, and a bevy of very powerful senators. I would include Senator Cantwell from Washington, Senator Sanders from Vermont, Senator Levin from Michigan, Senator Feinstein from California.
Mm-hmm.
On the House side, Waxman and Markey and Bart Stupak have just done some very good work in committee on this, and absolutely insist, get this job done. The reforms are out there. We know what they are. We just need to have the average citizen put their thumb on the scale to counterweight the substantial influence that bank lobbying will provide to prevent these reforms from being put in place.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is this not only has the opportunity to, not when I say derail the recovery, which isn't here anyway, but derail any recovery. I mean, the fact is that when we have gas approaching $3 already, in a time when we have a 9.4 print on the unemployment, we are talking a horrible recipe.
You have hit the nail on the head, you know? And just seeing what happened last summer, when gas gets to $3, people start getting uneasy.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to $4, you have economic dislocation. Last summer, the full weight of the recession hadn't occurred. We didn't know that we were going to end up with $640,000 on people unemployed month after month after month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go to $4 gas in this environment, whatever hope we have from coming out of this recession is going to be killed. And you know, let's not joke around. The word Great Depression is in the vocabulary. If we have $4 gasoline and corresponding increases in the price of heating oil, we really are risking a very, very serious economic dislocation. And frankly, the banks need to be saved from themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at making short-term profits. If we have another bubble, and the bursting bubble, they're going to have new sets of losses, and they're going to be returning to the Federal Treasury and saying we need more TARP money.
Of course.
And the cupboard is bare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think they think at this point, truly, what's the difference? If we lose money, we're going to go back to them anyway. But let me shift over something. Did you when you were dealing with at the CTFC, did you also deal with the futures market for the exchanges?
Oh, of course. I mean, basically, I was called, at the time they had a position called the Director of the Division of Trading and Markets, and we oversaw all the major exchanges, and we oversaw foreign boards of trade like ICE London that is in the United States now, trading in a unlevel playing field with NYMEX and the crude oil markets. And we fought a major battle 11 years ago to try and get a grip on the financial swaps market, which was deregulated. And you know, as we know from the credit default swaps fiasco, brought us the meltdown we're in today.
So what you know, I am having this very, very uneasy feeling on a continual basis that the futures market is being utilized as a heavy-duty leveraging to use money to push the stock market in total, and then therefore utilizing that leverage to push it so that you make money on the other side, if you follow what I'm saying.
I absolutely follow what you're saying. The leverage on the futures side, you know, people are used to when they hear the word margin on the equity side, you're talking about 50% margin. On the futures side, the margin is much, much less. On a normal futures contract, it's somewhere between 4 and 7%. And then you have these exchange-traded funds that double and triple gains. So there's an embedded margin in there that nobody's taking account for. And this is a major problem. In fact, my good friend Michael Masters has been a real hero in these things, just testified to the Senate Ag Committee about that very issue yesterday morning. And again, I think we are seeing the beginnings of the Obama administration through someone like Gary Gensler getting a handle on this, but he's only been in the chairmanship now for around 2 weeks. And frankly, you know, there's an increased body of knowledge within Congress. I could give you 20 names of members in the House and in the Senate who are getting on top of this. And to the extent you identify problems, your listeners identify problems, they should be getting on the phone with their members of Congress, senators, congressmen, and say, you've got to look at this. Because if we go to $4 gas, And there are other kinds of dislocations in stock prices from the kinds of transactions you're talking about. It's just going to be, you know, we think we're coming out of this thing, that there's a U-shaped curve here, and we've hit the bottom and are coming up. But if we have another set of dislocations like we had in September, October of 2008, this is going to be an L-shaped curve, and maybe worse than an L-shaped curve. We cannot play with matches when it comes to the economy, and everything we're talking about is a paper economy that is not transparent to the regulators or the average investor, that has destabilized us big time, and if we don't get a hold of it, we're going to look for serious worldwide losses of the kind we haven't seen since the Great Depression.
Let me just ask you one follow-up question. Because this is something I had this discussion just recently. I sat for a moment because something was just not sitting right for me with this incredible, as you say, dislocation. There's been numbers and numbers of days where we see the futures markets being down hard and the market opening up soft, just decent, you know, not down too much, turning around dramatically and going flying through the ceiling for no reason, and just really weird things that are happening. It bugs me, I got to tell you. But this is what I thought of. Tell me if I'm anywhere in fantasy land here, okay? You have a group that takes, I'm just using a number, $10 million and leverages it to, I don't know, $200, $400, $500 million with the leverage that you can use, worth of futures on the S&P 500, okay? You have that over here on the left side. What you do on the right side is you take $1 billion and you put it in a double leverage ETF of the S&P 500. At the low point of a day, at the opening point of a day, you buy that. Next thing you do is you whack the market with the futures. You hit that leverage position, you blow in really hard, and you don't care if you lose that money on that futures, if you will, right? Because you got the real money riding on the right-hand side with an ETF that doubles it. Is there any truth to any? Is that something that happens?
Well, I can't tell you whether it happens because, unfortunately, for the last 8 years, we have had nobody in either the SEC or the CFTC who care to look to see if it happened. But I am very hopeful. I may be naive, but I'm hopeful that the combination of Mary Shapiro at the SEC and Gary Gensler at the CFTC will open the door to those kinds of games. I mean, what you just said is very similar. I don't know whether you saw that YouTube session when Jim Cramer didn't realize that he was broadcasting to a broader audience, and he laid out a scenario about how he would pump up the price of the stock. It was done for his own personal
hedge fund. His hedge fund.
For his Street.com, for his own publication and the viewers on a YouTube hookup. And I mean, you should go back and see that. He's talking about the kinds of things you're talking about. However, without the ability to use these dangerous ETFs that double and triple the return, and, you know, really are outfoxing the controls that margin is supposed to play. So, yeah, I think you've got your hand on the pulse of the kind of problems we're seeing or that we hear about and should be worried about. What we have to do is get the SEC and the CFTC looking at this, and when I say looking at it, I also got to make the point that the CFTC is very understaffed. Gensler, the new chair, is pushing for more enforcement people. The playing field is not level here. We need more enforcement. We need to improve the quality of enforcement and the numbers of enforcers. And by the way, we ought to make sure the Justice Department, they're the guys who bring up criminal prosecutions. They have their hands filled. It's not normally something they worry about is financial wrongdoing, but I think we have to, you know, use our contacts with people who are in the House and Senate Judiciary Committee to hold the Justice Department to a very high standard here of finding out what is going on, the kinds of malpractices that you fear are happening, and I think you're right.
Let me ask you two questions, then we're going to end it really quick, really quick. Number one, so just to restate the point, the scenario that I've built is not only is definitely a possibility, and if you were to do that, that could work for you, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, it could work for you, but I don't want your listeners to be thinking they should go out and doing
that.
Not at all.
That's not the point at all.
Basically, my view is that whole Kramer episode, John Stewart episode.
I was actually on that episode. I was on the Stewart. You know, if you recall that episode when they came back and they said that was me talking about shorting on the
You know, and I mean, I think Mary Shapiro. Look, it takes time to get your sneakers on after 8 years of this malaise mm-hmm. in the enforcement world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Mary Shapiro and Gensler, their heart is in the right place. What we really have to do is get our members of Congress, get on the phone, tell them we're concerned about these things, all the things we talked about here. If they don't understand these problems, they should understand these problems. Get on top of it and push the regulators and the Department of Justice. Look, we've gone through the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Everybody knows, starting with the Madoff scandal, there was a lot of wrongdoing here. How many people do we see indicted for fraud or manipulation in what was clearly a market filled with malpractice?
Mm-hmm.
Unless we have examples of what will go wrong if you play games with the system, after we come out of this thing, we're going to be facing the same kind of problems all over again. We've got to get on top of this.
I hear you. Professor Greenberger, you're a good man. Keep up the good work, and thank you so much for joining us today, buddy.
You're welcome.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. What else can I say? I mean, it does seem like we're back in time. You know, you want to talk about the manipulation of the current commodity market. You want to talk about oil issues. You want to talk about the stock market itself and the futures issues. I don't know. Bottom line is, time to be cautious. That doesn't mean not be invested. That means be cautious. That means just don't throw it out there in the wind and just let, happen whatever happens. Stay on top of it. In other words, be disciplined as best as possible, which may mean a little, moving left and right and in and out if it's possible, if it's necessary. And that, there's nothing wrong with not getting all the gain, but there is something wrong with taking all the loss, I always say. So, you know what? I think it's time to, realize that some things are out of our control, and, that's okay also. We don't have to be on these markets every day, every second, watching every tick. Some of us like it, some of us don't. That's okay. The whole idea is to enjoy life. Let's face it, summer is here, like we said at the start of the show, and I think that overall, things are a little better now. We have a little bit more of a floor, but at the same time, we are developing a thesis of what could happen in about 2 to 3 months from now, considering the inventory supply chain and manufacturing all the way through the consumer, if we keep up a very heightened level of unemployment and, of course, a heightened level of commodity prices and oil, et cetera. That could be a real troubling factor. But nonetheless, I think there are some great opportunities that have come aboard of late. With that, we'll kind of end it today, and hopefully that you've enjoyed what we had to share. If you have any questions, if you want to comment, comment on the show. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the oil issue, your thoughts on the futures market issue. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This particular show notes, check it out, put in a comment, type it in. I'd love to hear what you have to say, and then we can kind of get a good two-way conversation continuing here. Again, thanks for joining me. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.